The fourth day. It had to happen sooner or later, and it happened sooner. The first man caught up in the Abwehr observe and apprehend operation was Maurice Chevalier. The French star was in transit between mistresses on the left bank, and who could possibly blame Unterscharführer Ganz for blowing the whistle on him? He was tall and gloriously handsome, he was exquisitely dressed, and he radiated such warmth, grace, confidence, and glamour that to see him was to love him. The servant was merely acting on the guidance given the squad by Macht. If you want him to be your best friend, that's probably the spy. The sergeant had no idea who Chevalier was. He thought he was doing his duty. Naturally, the star was not amused. He threatened to call his good friend Air General von Koltitz and have them all sent to the Russian front. And it's a good thing Macht still had some diplomatic skills left, for he managed to talk the elegant man out of that course of action by supplying endless amounts of unction and flattery. His dignity ruffled, the star left huffily and went on his way, at least secure in the knowledge that in 20 minutes he would be making love to a beautiful woman and these German peasants would still be standing around out in the cold, waiting for something to happen. By 8 p.m. he had forgotten entirely about it, and on his account no German boy serving in Paris would find himself on that frozen anti-tank gun. As for SS Hauptsturmführer Otto Bock, that was another story. He was a man of action. He was not one for the patience, the persistence, the professionalism of police work. He preferred more direct approaches, such as hanging around the Left Bank Hotel where Macht had set up his headquarters and threatening in a loud voice to send them all to Russia if they didn't produce the enemy agent quickly. Thus the Abwehr men took to calling him the Black Pigeon behind his back, for the name took into account his pigeon-like strut, breast puffed, dignity formidable, self-importance manifest, while accomplishing nothing tangible whatsoever except to leave small piles of shit wherever he went. His SS staff got with the drill, as they were, fanatics or not, at least security professionals, and it seemed that even after a bit they were calling him the Black Pigeon as well. But on the whole, they, the Abwehr fellows, and the 11th Battalion Feldpolizei people meshed well and produced such results as could be produced. The possibles they netted were not so spectacular as a regal movie star, but the theory behind each apprehension was sound. There were a number of handsome men, some gangsters, some actors, one poet, and a homosexual hairdresser. Macht and Abel raised their eyebrows at the homosexual hairdresser, for it occurred to them that the officer who had whistled him down had perhaps revealed more about himself than he meant to. Eventually, the first shift went off and the second came on. These actually were the sharper fellows, as Macht assumed that the British agent would be more likely to conduct his business during the evening, whatever that business might be. And indeed, the results were, if not better, more responsible. In fact, one man brought in revealed himself to be not who he claimed he was, and that he was a wanted jewel thief who still plied his trade, occupation or no. It took a shrewd eye to detect the vitality and fearlessness this fellow wore behind shoddy clothes and darkened teeth and an old man's hobble. But the SS man who made the catch turned out to be highly regarded in his own unit. Macht made a note to get him close to any potential arrest situations, as he wanted his best people near the action. He also threatened to turn the jewel thief over to the French police, but instead recruited him as an informant for future use. He was not one for wasting much. Another arrestee was clearly a Jew, even if his papers said otherwise, even if he had no possible connection to British intelligence. Macht examined the papers carefully, showed them to a bunco expert on the team, and confirmed that they were fraudulent. He took the fellow aside and said,
"Look, friend, if I were you, I'd get myself and my family out of Paris as quickly as possible. If I can see through your charade in 5 seconds, sooner or later the SS will too, and it's off to the east for all of you. These bastards have the upper hand for now, so my best advice to you is, no matter what it costs, get the hell out of Paris. Get out of France. No matter what you think, you cannot wait them out, because the one thing they absolutely will do before they're either chased out of town or put against a wall and shot is get all the Jews. That's what they live for. That's what they'll die for if it comes to that. Consider this fair warning and probably the only one you'd get. Maybe the man would believe him, maybe not. There was nothing he could do about it. He got back to the telephone as, along with his other detectives, he spent most of the time monitoring his various snitches, informants, sympathizers, and sycophants, of course turning up nothing. If the agent was on the left bank, he hadn't moved an inch. And he hadn't. Basil sat on the park bench the entire day, obliquely watching the German across the street. He got so he knew the man well, his gait, bad left hip, great war wound, his policeman's patience at standing in one place for an hour, then moving 2 meters and standing in that place for an hour, his stubbornness at never ever abandoning his post, except once, at 3 p.m., for a brief trip to the pissoir, during which he kept his eyes open and examined each passerby through the gap at the pissoir's eye level. He didn't miss a thing. That is, except for the dowdy Frenchman observing him from 90 meters away, over an array of daily newspapers. Twice, unmarked Citroëns came by and the officer gave a report to 2 other men, also in civilian clothes, on the previous few hours. They nodded, took careful records, and then hastened off. It was a long day until 7 p.m., a 12-hour shift, when his replacement moseyed up. There was no ceremony of changing the guard, just a cursory nod between them, and then the first policeman began to wander off. Basil stayed with him, maintaining the same 90-meter interval, noting that he stopped in a cafe for a cup of coffee and a sandwich, read the papers, and smoked, unaware that Basil had followed him in, placed himself at the bar, and also had a sandwich and a coffee. Eventually the German got up, walked another 6 blocks down Boulevard Saint-Germain, turned down a narrower street called Rue de Valois, and disappeared halfway down the first block into a rummy-looking hotel called Le Duval. Basil looked about, found a café, had a second coffee, smoked a Gauloise to blend in, joked with the bartender, was examined by a uniformed German policeman on a random check, showed papers identifying himself as Robert Fortier, picked freshly that morning, was checked off against a list. He was not on it, as perhaps Monsieur Fortier had not yet noted his missing papers, and was then abandoned by the policeman for other possibilities. At last he left and went back to Rue de Valois, slipped down it, and very carefully approached the Hotel Duval. From outside it revealed nothing, a typical Baedeker 2-star for commercial travelers, with no pretensions of gentility or class. It would be stark, clean, well-run, and banal. Such places housed half the population every night in Europe, except for the past few years when that half the population had slept in bunkers, foxholes, or ruins. Nothing marked this place, which was exactly why whoever was running this show had chosen it. Another pro like himself, he guessed. It takes a professional to catch a professional, the saying goes. He meekly entered as if confused, noting a few sour-looking individuals sitting in the lobby reading Deutsche Allgemeine Zeitung and smoking, and went to the desk, where he asked for directions to a hotel called Les Deux Gentilhommes, and got them. It wasn't much, but it enabled him to make a quick check on the place, and he learned what he needed to know. Behind the desk was a hallway, and down it, Basil could see a larger room, a banquet hall or something, full of drowsy-looking men sitting around listlessly, while a few further back slept on sofas pushed in for just that purpose. It looked police. That settled it. This was the German headquarters. He moseyed out and knew he had one more stop before tomorrow. He had to examine his objective. A few days previously, continued.
"Another book. Exactly yes and exactly no," said Sir Colin.
"How could there be a second original? By definition, there can be only one original, or so it was taught when I was at university."
"It does seem like a conundrum, does it not?" said Sir Colin. "But indeed we are dealing with a very rare case of a second original. Well, of sorts."
"Not sure I like the sound of that,"
said Basil. "Nor should you. It takes us to a certain awkwardness that, again, an ironist would find heartily amusing."
"You see," said Basil, "I am fond of irony, but only when applied to other chaps."
"Yes, it can sting, can it not?" said General Cavendish. "And I must say this one stings quite exhaustively. It will cause historians many a chuckle when they write the secret history of the war in the 21st century, after all the files are finally opened."
"But we get ahead of ourselves," said Sir Colin. "There's more tale to tell, and the sooner we tell it, the sooner the cocktail hour."
"Tell on, then, Sir Colin."
"It all turns on the fulcrum of folly and vanity known as the human heart, especially when basted in ambition, guilt, remorse, and greed. What a marvellous stew, all of it simmering within the head of Reverend McBurney. When we last left him, our God-fearing McBurney had become a millionaire because his pamphlet, The Path to Jesus, had sold endlessly, bringing him a shilling a tot. As I said, he retired to a country estate and spent some years happily wenching and drinking in happy debauchery."
"As who would not?" asked Basil, though he doubted this lot would.
"Of course, but then in the year 1789, 22 years later, he was approached by a representative of the Bishop of Gladney and asked to make a presentation to the church. To commemorate his achievement, the thousands of souls he had shepherded safely upon the aforenamed path, the bishop wanted him appointed deacon at St. Blaisfield's in Glasgow, the highest church rank a fellow like him could achieve. And Thomas wanted it badly, but the bishop wanted him to donate the original manuscript to the church for eternal display in its ambulatory. Except Thomas had no idea where the original was and hadn't thought about it in years. So he sat down, practical Scot that he was, and from the pamphlet itself he back-engineered, so to speak, another original manuscript in his own hand, a perfect facsimile, or as perfect as he could make it, even, one must assume, to the little crucifix doodles that so amused the Cambridge librarian. That was shipped to Glasgow, and that is why, to this day, Thomas McBurney lounges in heaven surrounded by seraphim and cherubim who sing his praises and throw petals where he walks."
"It was kind of God to provide us with the second copy," said Basil.
"Proof," said the Admiral, "that he is on our side." "Yes, the provenance of the first manuscript is well established. As I say, it has pencil marks to guide the printer in the print shop owner's hand. That is why it is so prized at Cambridge. The second was displayed for a century in Glasgow, and then the original St. Blaisfield's was torn down for a newer, more imposing one in 1857, and the manuscript somehow disappeared. However, it was discovered in 1913 in Paris. Who knows by what mischief it ended up there? But to prevent action by the French police, the owner anonymously donated it to a cultural institution, in whose vaults it to this day resides."
"So I am to go and fetch it, under the Nazis' noses?"
"Well, not exactly," said Sir Colin. "The manuscript itself must not be removed, as someone might notice and word might reach the Russians. What you must do is photograph certain pages using a Riga Minox. Those are what must be fetched."
"And when I fetch them, they can be relied upon to provide the key for the code and thus give up the name of the Russian spy at Bletchley Park, and thus you will be able to slip into his hands the German plans for Operation Citadel, and thus Stalin will fortify the Kursk salient, and thus the massive German summer offensive will have its back broken, and thus the boys will be home alive in 45 instead of dead in heaven in 47. Our boys, their boys, all boys."
"In theory," said Sir Colin Gubbins.
Not sure I like in theory," said Basil.
"You will be flown in by Lysander, dispatched in the care of Resistance Group Philippe, which will handle logistics. They have not been alerted to the nature of the mission as yet, as the fewer who know, of course, the better. You will explain it to them. They will get you to Paris for recon and supply equipment, manpower, distraction, and other kinds of support, then get you back out for Lysander pickup if everything goes well."
"And if it does not?"
"That is where your expertise will come in handy. In that case, it will be a maximum hugger-mugger sort of effort. I am sure you will prevail.
I am not, said Basil. It sounds awfully dodgy.
And you know, of course, that you will be given an L-pill so that the head full of secrets of yours will never fall into German hands.
I will be certain to throw it away at the first chance, said Basil.
There's the spirit, old man, said Sir Colin.
And where am I headed?
Ah, yes, an address on the Quai de Conti, the left bank, near the Seine.
Excellent, said Basil. Only the Institut de France, the most profound and colossal assemblage of French cultural icons in the world, and the most heavily guarded.
Known for its excellent library, said Sir Colin.
It sounds like quite a pickle, said Basil.
You haven't even heard the bad part.
The fourth day, near midnight. In the old days, and perhaps again after the war, if von Koltitz didn't blow up the place, the Institut de France was one of the glories of the nation, emblazoned in the night under a rippling tricolor to express the high moral purpose of French culture. But in the war, it, too, had to fall into line. Thus, the blazing lights no longer blazed, and the cupola ruling over the many stately branches of the singularly complex building overlooking the Seine on the Quai de Conti, right at the toe of the Ile de la Cité, and directly across from the Louvre in the 6th arrondissement, no longer ruled. One had to squint, as did Basil, to make it out, though helpfully a searchlight from some far distant German anti-aircraft battery would backlight it and at least accentuate its bulk and shape. The Germans had not painted it Feldgrau, thank God, and so its white stone seemed to gleam in the night, at least in contrast to other French buildings in the environs. A slight rain fell. The cobblestones glistened. The whole thing had a cinematic look that Basil paid no attention to, as it did him no good at all, and he was by no means a romantic. Instead, he saw the architectural tropes of the place, the brilliant facade of colonnades, the precision of the intersecting angles, the dramatically arrayed approaches to the broad steps of the grand entrance under the cupola, from which nexus one proceeded to its many divisions housed each in a separate wing. The whole expressed the complexity, the difficulty, the arrogance, the insolence, the ego, the whole je ne sais quoi of the French. Their smug, preposterous country, their easy treachery, their utter lack of conscience, their powerful sense of entitlement. From his briefing, he knew that his particular goal was the Bibliothèque Mazarine, housed in the great marble edifice but a few hundred meters from the center. He slid that way, while close at hand the Seine lapped against its stone banks. The odd taxi or bicycle taxi hurtled down Quai de la Conti. The searchlights crisscrossed the sky. Soon, midnight, and curfew. But he had to see. On its own, the Mazarine was an imposing building, though without the columns. Instead, it affected the French country palace look, with a cobblestone yard which in an earlier age had allowed for carriages but now was merely a car park. The two giant oak doors guarding French propriety kept interlopers out. At this moment it was locked up like a vault. Tomorrow the doors would open and he would somehow make his penetration. But how? With resistance help he could have mounted an elaborate ruse, spring himself to the upper floors while the guards tried to deal with the unruliness beneath. But he had chosen not to go that way. In the networks, somebody always talked, somebody always whispered, and nothing was really a secret. The resistance could get him close, but it could also earn him an appetizer of strychnine L-pill. The other, safer possibility was to develop contacts in the French underworld and hire a professional thief to come in from below or above via a back entrance and somehow steal the booklet, then replace it the next day. But that took time, and there was no time. In the end, he only confirmed what he already knew. There was but one way. It was as fragile as a Fabergé egg, at any time given to yield its counterfeit nature to anyone paying the slightest attention. Particularly with the Germans knowing something was up and at high alert, ready to flood the place with cops and thugs at any second. It would take nerve, a talent for the dramatic, and most important,
the right credentials.
A few days previously, Fini.
Are you willing? Said Sir Colin. Knowing all this, are you willing?
Sir, you send men to their death every day with less fastidiousness. You consign battalions to their slaughter without blinking an eye. The stricken grey ships turn to coffins and slide beneath the ocean with their hundreds. Sailor gear. The airplanes explode into falling pyres and nobody sheds a tear. Everyone must do his bit, you say. And yet now, for me, on this, you're suddenly squeamish to an odd degree, telling me every danger and improbability and how low the odds of success are. I have to know why. It has a doomed feel to it. If I must die, so be it. But somebody wants nothing on his conscience.
That is very true.
Is this a secret you will not divulge?
I will divulge, and what's more, now is the time to divulge, before we all die of starvation or alcohol withdrawal symptoms.
How very interesting.
A man on this panel has the ear of the Prime Minister. He holds great power. It is he who insisted on this highly unusual approach. It is he who forces us to over-brief you and send you off with far too much classified information. Let him speak, then.
General Sir Colin means me, said the professor. Because of my code-breaking success, I find myself uniquely powerful. Mr. Churchill likes me and wants me to have my way. That is why I sit on a panel with the barons of war, myself a humble professor, not even at Oxford or Cambridge, but at Manchester.
Professor, is this a moral quest? Do you seek forgiveness beforehand, should I die? It's really not necessary. I owe God a death, and he will take it when he sees fit. Many times over the years he has seen fit not to do so. Perhaps he's bored with me and wants me off the board. Perhaps he tires of my completely overblown legendary wit and sang-froid and realizes I'm just as scared as the next fellow, am a bully to boot, and that it ended on a rather beastly note with my father, a regret I shall always carry. So, Professor, you who have saved millions, if I go, it's on the chap upstairs, not you.
Well spoken, Captain St. Florian, like the hero I already knew you to be. But that's not quite it. Another horror lies ahead, and I must burden you with it, so I will be let alone enough by all those noisy screamers between my ears to do my work if the time comes.
Please enlighten.
You see, everyone thinks I'm a genius. Of course, I am really a frail man of many weaknesses. I needn't elucidate, but I'm terrified of one possibility. You should know it's there before you undertake.
Go ahead.
Let us say you prevail, at great cost, by great ordeal, blood, psychic energy, morale, whatever it takes from you. And perhaps other people will die as well. A pilot, a resistance worker, someone caught by a stray bullet, any of the routine whimsies of war.
Yes.
Suppose all that is true. You bring it back. You sit before me exhausted, spent, having been burned in the fire. You put it to me, the product of your hard labours, and I cannot decode the damned thing.
Sir, I...
They think I can, these barons of war. Put the tag genius on a fellow and it solves all problems. However, there are no, and I do mean no, assurances that the pages you bring back will accord closely enough with the original to yield a meaningful answer.
We've been through this 1,000 times, Professor Turing, said the General. You will be able, we believe, to handle this. We are quite confident in your ability and attribute your reluctance to a high-strung personality and a bit of stage fright, that's all. The variations cannot be that great, and your Turing engine, or one of those things you call a bomb, ought to be able to run down other possible solutions quickly, and we will get what we need.
I am so happy the men who know nothing of this sort of work are so confident. But I had to face you, Captain St. Florian, with this truth. It may be for naught. It may be undoable, even by the great Turing. If that is the case, then I humbly request your forgiveness.
Oh, bosh, said Basil. If it turns out that the smartest man in England can't do it, it wasn't meant to be done. Don't give it a thought, Professor. I'll simply go off and have an inning, as best I know how, and if I get back, then you have your inning. What happens, then that's what happens. Now, please, gentlemen, can we hasten? My arse feels as if Queen Victoria used it for needlepoint.